I want you to think back, just for a second, to the internet of 2004. Like, picture what it was actually like to open a computer back then.
Oh man, it was a completely different world.
Right. I mean, Internet Explorer was essentially ruling the digital world with an iron fist. They held like a staggering 95% market share.
Yeah, which is just insane to think about today.
It really is. It was a complete stranglehold on how everyone accessed information. I mean, they were ignoring standard web protocols, they were stifling new features, and frankly, the internet was just kind of, stuck in the mud.
Pretty much, there's no real innovation happening.
Exactly. And then, out of nowhere, this rebellious little browser arrives with this massive, audacious mission to, quote, take back the web. And that was Firefox 1.0.
It really was a revolution at the time, like a complete paradigm shift for developers and, well, everyday users who actually cared about how the internet functioned beneath the surface. You
Yeah,
know,
yeah.
it introduced tagged browsing to the mainstream, built-in pop-up blocking.
Oh my gosh, the pop-ups back then.
Right. It fixed things that we just take completely for granted today.
And the craziest part is that it actually worked. I mean, within a decade of that launch, they climbed the mountain and captured an 11% market share.
Which was a massive victory against a monopoly.
But I want you to snap back to today. It is July 2026, and that triumphant underdog story. Well, it has taken a very dark, a very complicated turn, because today Firefox is fighting for its very survival.
Yeah, and that is putting it mildly, to be honest. I mean, they have suffered a 76% market collapse since that 2015 peak.
Wow.
Yeah. If you look at the global browser market today, Firefox is sitting at a mere 2.6%.
Which is exactly why we are jumping into this today. Our source material for this deep dive is a genuinely fantastic, incredibly detailed report titled The Red Fox in a Golden Cage.
The great read. So much detail in there.
It really is. And our mission today is to unpack exactly how a champion of the open web collapsed so dramatically and why a massive chunk of its ongoing survival is, ironically, being funded by its absolute biggest rival.
That's the part that always shocks people.
Right. And we're also going to look at why a sudden 2026 rebellion by power users might just be the start of a massive comeback.
It is such a fascinating narrative to analyze because, well, at its core, this isn't really a story about software code at all.
No.
Not really. It is about platform economics. It's about the harsh realities of the market and just the sheer, gravitational pull of distribution.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because to really grasp how strange this current 2026 comeback is, we have to look at what went wrong after they peaked. We have to diagnose the fall.
Right, the three fatal blows.
Exactly. The report outlines three strategic disasters that basically gutted their market share. And the first one really starts with the thing sitting in your pocket right now.
Precisely. The shift that reshaped the entire tech landscape, which is the mobile revolution.
Yeah.
When Apple introduced the iPhone and, subsequently the App Store, the ground just completely shifted under Mozilla's feet. Today, mobile accounts for 60.7% of all global web traffic.
Which is just massive.
It is. That is where the internet lives now. And Firefox's share of that massive essential pie is just 0.5%.
Half of 1%. I mean, that is a brutal statistic. But how do you miss a shift that massive? Because, I have the Firefox app on my phone right now.
You do, yeah, but this is where the underlying mechanics of mobile operating systems really come into play. It was a combination of Mozilla being a bit slow to prioritize mobile, sure. But more importantly, it was about being completely locked out of the venue by the bouncers.
What do you mean by that?
Well, let's look at Apple's iOS. Apple instituted a strict mandate that every single third-party browser on the App Store must use Apple's own rendering engine, which is called WebKit.
Wait, let's pause there for a second just to make sure this makes sense. A rendering engine that's essentially the core machinery of the browser.
Exactly. Think of a rendering engine like a real-time translator. It takes all the raw and visible code of a website, like the HTML, the CSS formatting, the scripts.
The stuff regular people don't read.
Right. And it literally translates and paints it into the visual buttons, text, and images you actually interact with on your screen. Now, Mozilla has spent decades building their own highly customized rendering engine called Gecko.
Okay.
But because of Apple's mandate, they just aren't allowed to use it on the iPhone.
Wait, so when I download Firefox or even Chrome from the Apple App Store,
You are not actually using Firefox or Chrome under the hood. Not at all.
are you serious?
Yeah. You are essentially just using a Safari shell with a Firefox or Google skin painted on top.
Oh, wow. I had no idea.
Most people don't. But because of that iOS rule, Firefox was completely prevented from showcasing its own speed, its own privacy features, or its own engine innovations to iPhone users. They just couldn't differentiate themselves where it mattered most.
That is wild.
And then, you know, over on the Android side, Google simply pre-installed their own browser, Chrome, on virtually every single device shipped. It gave Chrome an insurmountable advantage right out of the gate.
That makes total sense, and it leads directly into the second massive blow for Firefox, which is all about how you actually get your software into people's hands.
Distribution.
Exactly. There is a quote in the report from tech analyst Ben Thompson that really stuck with me. He just states it so plainly. He says, quote, "Distribution eats technology."
And it is arguably the absolute truth of the software industry. I mean, Chrome did not win the browser war solely because it was faster or more secure in those early days.
Right.
It won because it was quite literally everywhere you looked.
Yeah.
Google launched Chrome in 2008, and they just threw the entire weight of their corporate machinery behind it.
Which is a very big machine.
Massive. Think about the leverage there. They put prominent download links for Chrome directly on the Google search homepage.
Which is the most visited website on planet Earth.
Exactly. You couldn't avoid it. They bundled it with other software. They made massive default installation deals with PC manufacturers.
The financial disparity outlined in the report is just, I mean, it's staggering. It notes that in 2025, Google paid out $11.2 million just in security bounties.
Just for finding bugs.
Right. That is money they just hand out to independent researchers purely for finding bugs in Chrome. And meanwhile, their annual marketing budget just for pushing Chrome is estimated at $500 million.
It's just a different stratosphere.
It really is. Compare that to Mozilla. Mozilla's entire annual revenue as a company in 2022 was $593 million. So Google basically spends almost Mozilla's entire corporate revenue just on marketing one single product.
Yeah, which brings us to the third and, frankly, most ironic factor in Firefox's decline, which is their sheer financial dependency on the very giant they are trying to fight.
This is the crazy part.
Yeah, where do you think Mozilla's $593 million actually comes from?
This is the part of the report that absolutely blew my mind. 80 to 85% of Mozilla's revenue comes directly from Google.
Yep.
Like, Google literally writes Mozilla a check for hundreds of millions of dollars annually just to ensure that Google remains the default search engine when you type something into the Firefox address bar.
Correct. Mozilla is fundamentally financially dependent on their biggest competitor.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because this feels like a critically acclaimed indie film playing in one local theater, trying to compete with a massive Marvel blockbuster.
Right.
But the theater owner forces the Marvel movie onto every screen in the building and restricts the indie film to, like, one broken seat in the back. And to make it even weirder, Marvel is the one paying the indie director's rent just to keep them in business.
I mean, that is a remarkably accurate way to visualize platform economics. But it immediately raises a really important question, right? Why?
Yeah, exactly. Google is a ruthless business. Why would they voluntarily fund a competitor's resistance?
Exactly.
I'm guessing this isn't out of the goodness of their hearts.
No, not at all. It all comes down to antitrust law. You see, if Firefox runs out of money and dies, their independent rendering engine, Gecko, dies with it.
Okay.
And if Gecko disappears, Chrome and its underlying Chromium architecture achieve a complete, undeniable monopoly over how the entire world accesses the web.
And the government doesn't like monopolies.
Regulators globally are already deeply concerned about Google's overarching power. So by paying to keep Firefox alive, Google can essentially point to Mozilla in a courtroom and say, look, the market is highly competitive. Consumers have other independent options.
Oh, wow. So it's an insurance policy, like a $500 million annual insurance policy against getting broken up by the government.
That's exactly what it is.
But the catch is that the U.S. Department of Justice is currently scrutinizing those exact default search agreements in their ongoing antitrust case against Google.
Right, which is huge.
Yeah. If the DOJ steps in and kills that specific deal, Mozilla loses 80% of its revenue overnight.
It is a terrifying, really precarious position for a company to be in. But as we mentioned at the start, despite being totally financially dependent on Google and, you know, vastly outmatched in mobile and desktop distribution, Firefox is actually Oh, they're growing again right now.
Yes. This is where the story completely shifts.
Yeah.
The 2026 desktop market share data is just wild to look at. In January of this year, Firefox was sitting at 4.05%.
Right.
But by March, it jumped to 4.59%. I mean, it's a fraction of a percent, sure, but it is the first time they have seen actual sustained growth in 7 years.
It's a huge shift in momentum.
And it's all happening because Google just crossed a massive red line for their power users, didn't they?
They did. The Manifest V3 saga, this is a crucial, crucial turning point.
Let's get into this because it's fascinating. In April 2025, Google publicly reversed its longstanding promise to get rid of third-party tracking cookies.
Which frustrated a lot of privacy advocates.
Definitely. But the real spark of this 2026 rebellion was the release of Chrome version 147. With that update, Chrome completely transitioned its extensions to a new underlying architecture called Manifest V3.
Yeah.
Now, Google claims this shift is necessary for, quote, security and performance. But critics, developers, and power users are openly calling it the death of the ad blocker.
And if you look at the technical mechanics, the critics have a very valid point. I mean, the core issue lies in a new technical bottleneck that Google introduced within Manifest V3.
What's it called?
It's something called the Declarative Net Request API.
Okay, we need to break that down. What exactly is that API doing?
Well, let's explain how ad blockers traditionally work first. When you load a website, your ad blocker checks every incoming piece of data against a massive list of known tracking servers and ad networks, and it blocks them in real time.
Like a filter.
Exactly. But under the new Manifest V3 rules, Chrome hard caps the number of static rules an extension is allowed to use at exactly 30,000.
Now, to a casual user, 30,000 rules probably sounds like plenty.
It does. It sounds like a lot, until you realize the scale of modern internet tracking. Think of an ad blocking rule like a bouncer at a nightclub, checking IDs against a blacklist of known troublemakers.
Okay.
Google is essentially telling the bouncer, you are only allowed to memorize 30,000 faces. The problem is the internet has over 300,000 known trackers.
Oh, wow. So they're missing almost all of them.
Yeah. The absolute gold standard for ad blocking is an extension called uBlock Origin, which has over 20 million users. Full uBlock Origin requires over 300,000 filter rules, plus complex dynamic filtering, to actually protect your browsing.
So it's way over the cap.
Way over the cap. Because of Chrome 147's arbitrary new cap, the full, uncompromising version of uBlock Origin is officially dead on Chrome.
That is huge. I mean, the creator of uBlock actually had to release a heavily watered-down version called uBlock Origin Lite just to comply with Google's new limits.
Yeah, which just isn't the same.
Not at all. But Firefox, meanwhile, is the only mainstream browser left that still fully supports the older architecture, Manifest V2, alongside the new one. Meaning the bouncer can memorize as many faces as he needs to.
Exactly.
There is a great quote in the report from software developer and YouTuber Jeff Delaney. He posted a video about this that got over 2 million views, and he just plainly stated, quote, I switched back to Firefox because uBlock Origin actually works, and I'm tired of Google deciding what I can block.
It is a sentiment that is clearly resonating with a lot of highly technical users. I mean, this isn't just about software preferences anymore. It's about control over your own digital environment.
But I want to push back on this logic just for a second. We just established that Google is literally paying hundreds of millions of dollars to keep Firefox alive so they don't look like a monopoly.
Right.
If they need Firefox to stay small but alive, why would Google aggressively push an update like Manifest V3 that actively drives millions of their most influential vocal power users directly into Firefox's arms? I mean, it seems totally counterproductive.
What's fascinating here is that you have to take a step back and remember what Google fundamentally is as a business.
Okay.
They are not a web browser company. They are, first and foremost, an advertising company.
Right. That's where the money comes from.
Exactly. Their entire core business model relies on ad tracking architecture.
Yeah.
They're currently rolling out their new privacy sandbox things like the Topics API, which changes how ad targeting works.
Ah, I see.
So Google's calculus is simple. They are perfectly willing to bleed a small fraction of furious power users over to Firefox if it means they can secure, standardize, and lock down their ad tracking architecture for the 66.7% of the desktop market they still absolutely control.
Wow. Okay, so they are basically sacrificing a few pawns to protect the king, which is the ad revenue.
That's exactly it.
That makes total sense. But, you know, ideology and ad blocking aside, For you, the listener, to actually consider switching your default browser and disrupting your workflow, the software has to actually perform.
It can't be sluggish.
Exactly. So let's look under the hood. The report breaks down the hard 2026 benchmark data comparing Chrome 147 directly against Firefox 150. And the results basically tell a tale of two very different engineering philosophies: raw speed versus system efficiency.
It is a really striking contrast in priorities.
Yeah.
If we look strictly at raw rendering speed, Chrome is still the undisputed winner.
Really?
Yeah. The researchers ran both browsers through seven industry standard benchmarks, and Chrome won six of them. Chrome's V8 JavaScript engine is just an absolute powerhouse at crunching complex web applications. In the widely respected Speedometer 3.1 test, Chrome maintained a 14.1% advantage over Firefox.
To put that into context, the report notes that a 14.1% advantage is basically the equivalent of getting one entirely free hardware generation upgrade.
Which is massive.
It is massive. If you are using incredibly heavy web apps all day, think web-based Figma, heavy Google Docs, or browser-based WebGL games, Chrome is simply going to feel noticeably snappier and more responsive.
It will. You really can't deny the math there. But speed isn't the only metric that defines a good browsing experience.
True.
Where Firefox completely changes the conversation and fights back is in resource efficiency. Firefox boasts a massive 21.8% faster cold start time.
So it opens faster.
Right. So if you just need to click the icon, open the browser, check a quick email, and close it, Firefox gets you there significantly faster. But the real tangible victory for everyday users is in memory management.
Ah, the RAM war. Chrome's reputation for eating your computer's random access memory is basically legendary at this point.
It's a meme at this point.
It is. So the researchers actually put this to a brutal stress test. They opened 20 identical heavy tabs in both browsers simultaneously. Gmail, YouTube playing video, GitHub, Figma, Slack, all the heavy hitters.
The real world torture test.
Exactly. And the results are undeniable. Firefox uses 18% less RAM across the board.
Let's put real physical numbers to that percentage because it's wild. In that 20-tab stress test, Chrome was chewing through 5,812 megabytes of your computer's memory.
Ouch.
Yeah. Firefox was only using 4,764 megabytes. You were saving over an entire gigabyte of memory just by choosing Firefox.
That is a lot of memory.
And the architecture gets even better over time. After 2 hours of idle time, once both browsers put their background tabs to sleep, Firefox's memory savings jumped to 25%. It reclaims unused memory much more aggressively than Chrome does.
Here's where it gets really interesting to me. Because if you think about it, Chrome is essentially a Formula One car.
Okay, I like this.
Right. It is unbelievably fast. It wins all the benchmark races, but it absolutely guzzles your computer's gas, which is your RAM.
Yeah.
Firefox, on the other hand, is the hyper-efficient hybrid vehicle.
I love that analogy. And if you build on it, you know, if you only need to drive one block to the grocery store, say, you just want to open a few tabs to read some articles while doing other work, you don't need the Formula One car idling in your driveway, deafening the whole neighborhood. You want the hybrid. For anyone using a standard work laptop with 8 or 16 gigs of RAM who is trying to run a web browser alongside a video editor or coding software.
Which is a lot of people.
Tons of people. That single gigabyte of saved memory is literally the difference between your computer running smoothly and the entire system grinding to a frozen, stuttering halt.
We do need to be totally fair to Chrome's engineering team, though, because the report acknowledges that some of Chrome's memory bloat isn't just, you know, lazy turding or waste. It's heavily tied to a specific security feature called site isolation.
Yes, that is a crucial technical point to understand. Site isolation accounts for roughly 10 to 13% of Chrome's total memory overhead.
How does that work?
Well, here's how it functions. To keep you secure, Chrome literally spins up a completely separate operating system process for every single tab you open.
Wow, every single one.
Every single one. They introduce this to combat what are known as Spectre class side channel attacks, which essentially allow malicious websites to try and peek into the memory data of other tabs you might have open, like your bank account.
Oh, that sounds bad.
It is. So it's a genuinely robust, very paranoid security architecture. Now, Firefox does have its own version of this called Project Fission, which has been enabled by default for years. But Chrome's implementation is slightly more granular and heavily audited by the security community, which is why it uses more RAM.
Okay, so raw speed belongs to Chrome, and RAM efficiency belongs to Firefox. The ultimate tiebreaker for everyday users and for you listening right now comes down to privacy and how you actually operate day to day.
Right.
So let's talk about the privacy war, because the data here is just night and day.
It really is. The researchers ran both browsers through the Electronic Frontier Foundation's Cover Your Tracks tool. This is a diagnostic test that measures how easily a browser can be fingerprinted.
Let's explain fingerprinting, because it's way more invasive than just, you know, standard cookies.
Absolutely. Even if you block cookies entirely, tracking companies can identify your specific device by looking at unique combinations of your screen resolution, the specific fonts installed on your computer, your operating system version, and even your hardware configuration.
That's so creepy.
It is. They combine all those tiny, seemingly harmless details into a unique, quote-unquote, fingerprint that tracks you as you move from site to site.
And the result of the test? Well, with Chrome's standard out-of-the-box default settings, it leaves 17.8 fingerprint bits.
Which is fine.
The report notes that this score is highly trackable. Like, advertisers can easily and reliably identify you across different browsing sessions. Firefox, on its standard default settings, leaves 14.1 bits.
So it is better, but you can still be somewhat tracked.
Exactly. But then you go into Firefox settings and turn on strict mode.
And the fingerprint bits plummet down to 8.3.
8.3. The report states that an 8.3 score approaches the anonymity levels of the Tor browser. But you don't have to suffer through the agonizing network lag that makes Tor so difficult to use for regular daily browsing.
Exactly. It's usable security.
And Firefox is the only mainstream browser currently on the market that can pull that off.
And they can pull it off because Mozilla treats privacy as a fundamental baseline right out of the box, not an afterthought. They default to blocking third-party tracking cookies, malicious crypto miners, and social media trackers.
That's great.
Furthermore, they use a feature called Total Cookie Protection. Think of it like giving every single website you visit its own separate locked cookie jar.
Okay, I like that visual.
If a tracker on a news site tries to reach into the cookie jar of your social media site to see what you've been doing, it simply can't. They are physically isolated from one another.
That is brilliant. Meanwhile, to get even baseline rudimentary privacy on Chrome, you have to dig through buried, confusing settings menus just to flip a toggle that might get overridden in the next update anyway.
Very true. So let's make this incredibly practical. Let's look at your desk right now. If you're listening to this at work and you have 30 tabs open Slack, a dozen emails, Spotify, spreadsheets, which browser camp do you actually belong in?
Well, the report breaks this down into four very pragmatic, real-world scenarios. Scenario one is the Google ecosystem worker.
Okay.
If your entire professional life revolves around Google Workspace Docs, Meet, Drive, Drives, you honestly should probably stay on Chrome. Google Docs renders roughly 9 to 12% faster on Chrome's engine, and the native integration with Google's ecosystem is just frictionless.
Yeah, that makes sense. What's the next one?
Scenario two is the hardware-constrained user. If you're sitting on a laptop with only 4GB or 8GB of RAM, you desperately need Firefox's 18% memory advantage.
Oh, absolutely.
The researchers actually proved this. On an 8GB machine, Firefox held 20 heavy tabs without having to swap memory to the hard drive. Chrome started choking and struggling at tab 14.
Wow. Okay, scenario three. Scenario three is specifically for the web developers. The hard truth of the industry is that Chrome's dev tools are still the absolute gold standard. They have vastly superior Lighthouse integration for auditing, and they've integrated new AI insights powered by Gemini.
So they should just stick to Chrome.
Well, the standard recommendation is to build and develop your sites in Chrome, but you absolutely must test them in Firefox, because a significant growing percentage of your most privacy-conscious users will never touch a Chromium browser.
Good advice. And finally, scenario four, the privacy advocate. If you care deeply about your personal data, the stack you need to run today is Firefox on strict mode, utilizing their total cookie protection and ideally pairing it with the Mozilla VPN.
It ultimately all comes down to your personal priorities. Chrome is structurally engineered for convenience, speed, and seamless ecosystem integration. Firefox is engineered for resource efficiency and for treating your privacy as a non-negotiable default state.
Which brings us to the elephant in the room.
Yeah.
I mean, it is genuinely great that Firefox has carved out this highly efficient, privacy-first niche.
Yes, it is.
The tech is incredibly solid, and the power user base is finally growing again. But none of these technical victories matter if the company runs out of money tomorrow.
No, they do not.
So let's look at the doomsday clock. What actually happens in 2028?
Everything hinges on that looming U.S. Department of Justice antitrust threat we discussed earlier.
Right.
If the government formally rules that Google's default search payment to Mozilla is an illegal, anti-competitive practice, Mozilla loses roughly $500 million annually. Poof! It just vanishes from their balance sheet.
So what does this all mean for them? How on earth does a company replace a $500 million check overnight?
You simply don't do it overnight, which is exactly why Mozilla is currently trying to execute a desperate multi-phase survival strategy before a ruling comes down.
What's the strategy?
Phase one is a push for immediate incremental financial independence. They are aggressively pushing Firefox Premium, which is a $5 to $10 a month subscription offering advanced privacy features.
Okay, subscriptions.
Right. They are also building out B2B licensing for privacy-conscious enterprises and selling access to data clean rooms for publishers.
And phase two is about expanding their footprint, right? Leaning into the Mozilla VPN and trying to build out privacy-preserving advertising tools to prove that the web can still be profitable for creators without resorting to invasive cross-site tracking.
Exactly. They have to prove alternative business models can actually work. But phase three, the long-term architectural play, is probably the most interesting.
What are they doing there?
They want to turn their Gecko rendering engine into an open modular architecture, essentially letting independent software developers package Gecko inside their own applications, offering an alternative to Chromium across the entire software ecosystem.
Even with all those phases, the projections for 2028 in the report are, well, they're incredibly sobering. The analysts give three potential probabilities for Firefox's future.
Yeah, let's hear them.
The most likely scenario at a 50% probability is that Firefox just slowly declines and stabilizes at a 2% market share. It becomes a much smaller, sustainable niche product supported entirely by user donations and premium tiers.
So it's not dead, but it ceases to be a major player in dictating web standards.
Exactly. Then there is a 30% chance they actually see a resurgence and grow to 5%. But this relies on a few external factors.
Like what?
Well, if EU regulators successfully force Apple to completely drop the iOS WebKit mandate, allowing the true Gecko engine onto iPhones, and if the Manifest V3 backlash continues to drive developers and power users away from Chrome in droves, they could reclaim some very real ground.
I could see that happening, actually.
But then there's the 20% probability, complete extinction.
Ouch.
Yeah. If the DOJ kills the Google deal and that revenue cannot be replaced fast enough, the report predicts Firefox enters bare-bones maintenance mode by 2029. All new innovative development stops. It just becomes a static relic of the early web.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the crisis Firefox is currently navigating isn't really about code optimization or memory usage anymore, is it?
Not at all. It is entirely a business and distribution challenge. I mean, Firefox didn't lose the browser war because it was a flawed product.
Right.
It lost because Google had essentially infinite capital and achieved total control over the physical and digital distribution channels.
Exactly. Which is why your personal choice of browser matters significantly more than you might realize.
Oh, totally.
It isn't merely a software decision about RAM efficiency or which password manager has a better interface. It is quite literally a vote on who gets to control the underlying architecture of the internet.
Firefox is the very last fully independent rendering engine standing between us and a total Chromium monopoly. If Firefox officially enters extinction mode and the independent Gecko engine dies, the open web essentially becomes a proprietary Google intranet.
That's a scary thought.
It really is. Every future web standard, every new privacy protocol, and the entire future of ad blocking capabilities will be exclusively dictated by a single advertising company's bottom line.
Wow.
So keeping in mind that rebellious little browser that tried to take back the web in 2004, when you sit down at your desk and open your laptop tomorrow, ask yourself, are you browsing the World Wide Web or are you just browsing Google's version of it?